Grandfather was in fine fettle. Marius had a few cases to plead here and there. Alongside the newly married couple, Aunt Gillenormand peacefully led the marginal life that was all she required. Jean Valjean came every day. With familiarity gone, with this vous instead of tu, with this madame and this Monsieur Jean, he was a different person for Cosette. The care he had himself taken to get her to let go of him was doing its work on her. She was more and more lively and less loving. She was still very fond of him, though, and he felt that. One day she suddenly said to him, "You used to be my father, and now you aren't my father any more. You used to be my uncle, and now you aren't my uncle any more. You used to be Monsieur Fauchelevent, and now you are just plain Jean. So who are you, really? I don't like all this. If I didn't know how good you were, I'd be frightened of you." He still lived in the Rue de l'Homme Armé, not being able to bring himself to move from the quartier where Cosette lived. At first he would spend only a couple of minutes with Cosette at a time, then he would go away. Little by little he developed the habit of staying longer. It was as though he was taking advantage of the authorization provided by the days as they got longer. He arrived earlier and left later. One day Cosette accidentally called him father. A flash of joy lit up Jean Valjean's somber old face. He pulled her up. "Call me Jean."
"Ah, that's right," she said, and burst out laughing. "Monsieur Jean."
"That's more like it," he said. And he turned his head away, so that she could not see him drying his eyes. They remembered the garden in the Rue Plumet. That was the last time, after that momentary flash of light, complete extinction was achieved. No more familiarity, no more greeting with a kiss, never again that word so profoundly sweet, father. At his own behest and with his own complicity, he was gradually driven away from every happiness. And he endured this misery that, after having lost Cosette completely in one day, he then had to lose her all over again a bit at a time. The eye ends up adapting to dingy cellar light. In a word, his daily glimpse of Cosette was enough for him. His whole life was concentrated in those moments. He would sit next to her and look at her in silence, or else he would talk to her about days long gone, about her childhood, about the convent, about her little friends at the time. One afternoon, it was one of the first days of April, already hot, still fresh, that time of the year when the sun is so jaunty, the gardens around Marius and Cosette's windows seemed visibly to be waking up, the hawthorn was about to break out, a jeweled array of wallflowers was spreading out over the old walls, pink snapdragons yawned in the cracks between the stones. Lovely little daisies and buttercups were just starting to push up through the grass. White butterflies made their first appearance of the year, and the wind, that fiddler at life's eternal wedding, tried out in the trees the first notes of that great dawn symphony the old poets used to call renewal. Marius said to Cosette, "We said we'd go back and see our garden in the Rue Plumet. Let's go. We shouldn't be ungrateful." And off they flew into the spring like two swallows. The garden in the Rue Plumet had the same effect on them as the dawn. Already in their lives they had behind them something like the springtime of their love. The house in the Rue Plumet still belonged to Cosette, having been taken out on a lease. They went through the garden and through the house. There they found themselves again, and lost themselves again. That evening, at the usual time, Jean Valjean went to the Rue des Filles du Calvaire. "Madame has gone out with Monsieur and is not back yet," Basque told him. He sat down in silence and waited for an hour. Cosette did not come home. He bowed his head and went on his way. Cosette was so intoxicated by her walk with Marius in their garden and so overjoyed at having lived in her past for a whole day that she could talk of nothing else the next day. It never occurred to her that she had not seen Jean Valjean.
"How did you get there?" Jean Valjean asked her.
"On foot."
"And how did you get back?"
"In a fiacre."
For some little time, Jean Valjean had noticed the cramped life the young couple led. It made him cranky. Marius's economizing was severe, and Jean Valjean meant the word in its absolute sense. He hazarded a question.
Why don't you have your own carriage? A pretty coupe would only set you back 500 francs a month. You're rich.
I don't know, replied Cosette.
It's like Toussaint, Jean Valjean went on. She's gone, but you haven't replaced her. Why not?
Nicolette's enough.
But you need a lady's maid.
I have Marius, don't I?
You ought to have a house of your own. Servants of your own, a carriage, a box at the theatre. Nothing is too good for you. Why not take advantage of the fact that you're rich? Wealth only adds to happiness.
Cosette did not answer. Jean Valjean's visits did not get any shorter, far from it. When it is the heart that is slipping, you don't stop on the way down. Whenever Jean Valjean wanted to prolong his visit and make her forget the time, he would praise Marius. He would find him handsome, noble, courageous, witty, eloquent, good. Cosette would outdo him. Jean Valjean would start again. They never dried up. Marius, that word was inexhaustible. Those 6 letters spoke volumes. This way, Jean Valjean managed to stay for a long while. To see Cosette, to forget by her side, was so sweet to him. It was the dressing of his wound. It happened several times that Basque had come twice to say, Monsieur Gillenormand has sent me to remind Madame la Baronne that dinner is served. On those days, Jean Valjean would return home in a very thoughtful mood. Was there, then, some truth in that comparison with the chrysalis that had popped into Marius's mind? Was Jean Valjean, in fact, a chrysalis, who would dig his heels in and would go on coming over to visit his butterfly? One day he stayed even longer than usual. The next day he noticed that there was no fire in the grate.
Right, he thought, no fire.
And he furnished himself with this explanation. It's quite simple. It's now April. The cold is over.
God, it's cold in here, cried Cosette as she came in.
No, it's not, said Jean Valjean.
So it was you who told Basque not to light a fire?
Yes. Soon it will be May.
But we light fires up until the month of June. In this cellar, you have to light them all year round.
I thought we wouldn't need a fire.
Another one of your funny ideas, Cosette scolded.
The day after that, there was a fire. But the 2 armchairs had been moved away across the room, next to the door.
What is that supposed to mean? Thought Jean Valjean.
He went to get the armchairs and put them back in their usual place, by the fireside. Still, the fact that the fire had been lit again encouraged him. He made their chat last even longer than usual. As he got up to go, Cosette said to him,
My husband said a funny thing to me yesterday.
What was that?
He said to me, Cosette, we have 30,000 livres in income, 27 from you and the 3 that my grandfather gives me. I said, That makes 30. He went on, Would you have the courage to live on 3,000? I said, Yes, on nothing, as long as it was with you. And then I asked, Why are you asking? He answered, I just wanted to see.
Jean Valjean could think of nothing to say. Cosette probably expected him to give her some explanation. He listened to her in mournful silence. He returned to the Rue de l'Homme Armé so profoundly absorbed that he got the door wrong, and instead of going into his place, he went into the place next door. It was only after climbing nearly 2 flights of stairs that he realized his mistake and went downstairs again. His mind was racked with surmise. It was clear that Marius had his doubts about the origins of those 600,000 francs, that he feared some illicit source. Who knows? Perhaps he'd even found out that the money came from him, Jean Valjean, and was hesitating in the face of a suspect fortune, loath to accept it as his own, preferring for them to remain poor, he and Cosette, than to enjoy a tainted wealth. On top of this, Jean Valjean was vaguely beginning to feel he was being turned away. The following day, when he stepped into the downstairs room, he had a kind of jolt. The armchairs had disappeared. There was not even a chair.
What? cried Cosette on entering. No armchairs! What on earth has happened to the armchairs?
They're not here any more, replied Jean Valjean.
That's a bit much.
Jean Valjean stammered. I told Basque to take them away.
The reason being?
I'll only be staying a few minutes today.
Staying only a little while is no reason for staying standing up.
I think Basque needed armchairs for the drawing room.
What for?
No doubt you're having people over this evening.
We're not having anyone.
Jean Valjean could not say another word. Cosette gave a shrug.
Fancy getting them to take the armchairs away. The other day you had the fire put out. You really are quite peculiar.
Adieu, murmured Jean Valjean. He did not say, adieu, Cosette. But he did not have the strength to say, adieu, madame. He went away, crushed. This time the meaning was all too clear. The next day he did not come. Cosette did not even notice till that evening.
Fancy, she said, Monsieur Jean didn't come today.
Her heart gave a slight lurch, but she scarcely registered it, immediately distracted as she was by a kiss from Marius. The day after that, he did not come. Cosette did not give it a thought. She whiled away her evening and slept away her night as if nothing had happened, and only thought about it when she woke up. She was so happy. She sent Nicolette off swiftly to Monsieur Jean's to see if he was sick and to see why he hadn't turned up the night before. He was not sick, he was busy. He would come soon, just as soon as he could. In any case, he was going on a short trip. Madame might remember that it was his habit to go on trips from time to time. No one should worry on his account, no one should give him a thought. Nicolette, on entering Monsieur Jean's, had repeated to him the exact words her mistress had used, that Madame was sending her to see why Monsieur Jean had not come the night before.
It's been 2 days since I was last there, said Jean Valjean softly.
But the observation was lost on Nicolette, who didn't breathe a word of it to Cosette.
Attraction and Extinguishment. During the late spring and early summer of 1833, occasional passers-by in the Marais, shopkeepers, loungers idling on doorsteps, noticed an old man neatly dressed in black who, every day at around the same time, at dusk, would come out of the Rue de l'Homme Armé, near the Rue Sainte-Croix de la Bretonnerie, go past the Rue des Blancs Manteaux, as far as the Rue Culture Sainte-Catherine, and, having reached the Rue de la Charpe, turn left into the Rue Saint-Louis. There he would walk slowly, his head thrust forward, seeing nothing, hearing nothing, his eyes immutably fixed on a point that was always the same, that seemed to him to be glittering with stars, and yet was nothing more than the corner of the Rue des Filles du Calvaire. The closer he got to that street corner, the brighter his eyes would grow. A sort of joy would light up his pupils like an inner dawn. He looked fascinated and overcome with emotion. His lips would move slightly as though he were talking to someone he could not see. He would smile vaguely and slow his pace to a crawl. You would have said that while he wanted to get there, he was afraid of the moment when he would be quite close. When there were no more than a few houses between himself and this street that seemed to draw him like a magnet, his steps would slow down to such an extent that at times you could be forgiven for thinking he had stopped walking. His wobbling head and his staring eyes reminded you of a compass needle seeking the magnetic pole. However long he managed to defer his arrival, he had to arrive sometime. He would reach the Rue des Filles du Calvaire, then he would stop. He would shake, he would poke his head round the corner of the end house with a sort of grim timidity, and there he would gaze into the street. And in that tragic gaze there was something that resembled the bedazzlement of the impossible and the reflection of a paradise that was shut. Then a tear that had gathered slowly in the corner of his eye would grow big enough to fall and would slide down his cheek and sometimes stop at his mouth. The old man would taste its bitterness. He would stay like this for a few minutes, as though turned to stone. Then he would go back the way he had come, just as slowly, and the farther away he got, the more the light in his eyes would go out. Little by little the old man stopped going as far as the corner of the Rue des Filles du Calvaire. He would stop halfway down the Rue Saint-Louis, sometimes a bit farther away, sometimes a bit closer. One day, he stayed at the corner of the Rue Culture Sainte-Catherine and gazed at the Rue des Filles du Calvaire from afar. Then he silently shook his head from side to side, as though he were denying himself something. And he retraced his steps. Soon, he did not even go as far as the Rue Saint-Louis. He would get to the Rue Pavée, shake his head, and turn back. Then he would go no farther than the Rue des Trois Pavillons. Then he would not go beyond the Rue des Blancs Manteaux. He was like a pendulum of a clock that has stopped being wound up, whose swings get shorter and shorter before stopping altogether. Every day he left his place at the same time. He set out on the same route, but he no longer finished it, and, without perhaps realizing it, he made it shorter and shorter all the time. His whole face expressed this one idea: what's the use? His eyes were dead. The light had gone out. The tear, too, had dried up. It no longer gathered in the corner of his eye. That thoughtful eye was dry. The old man's head was always thrust forward. His chin quivered at times. The folds on his thin neck would break your heart. Sometimes, when the weather was bad, he would have his umbrella tucked under his arm, but he would not open it. The good women of the quartier would say, "That man's an innocent." Children would follow him, laughing. Book 9. Supreme Darkness, Supreme Dawn. Pity for the unhappy, but indulgence for the happy. It is a terrible thing to be happy. How we content ourselves with it. How easily we find it to be the be-all and end-all. How easily, having attained that false aim of life, happiness, we forget the real aim, duty. We must say, though, that it would be wrong to blame Marius. Marius, as we explained, had not put any questions to Monsieur Fauchelevent before his marriage, and since then had been afraid to put any to Jean Valjean. He had regretted the promise he had let the man drag out of him. He had told himself over and over that he was wrong to make that concession to despair. He had restricted himself to gradually banishing Jean Valjean from the house and erasing him as much as possible from Cosette's mind. He had always, in a way, stood between Cosette and Jean Valjean, sure that this way she would not notice the man and would not think about him. It was more than erasure, it was an eclipse. Marius did what he judged necessary and right. He believed he had serious reasons for pushing Jean Valjean out of the way, without harshness, but without weakness. The same serious reasons we have already seen, and others we will see later. Having met by chance, during a trial in which he was acting for the defense, a former clerk from the banking house of Lafitte, without looking for it, he had obtained mysterious information that he had not, if the truth be known, been able to delve into any further, out of that very respect for the secret he had promised to keep, and out of consideration for Jean Valjean's precarious situation. He believed, at that particular moment, that he had a grave duty to perform, which was the restitution of the 600,000 francs to someone he was looking for as discreetly as possible. Meanwhile, he refrained from touching the money. As for Cosette, she was not in on any of these secrets, but it would be hard to condemn her either. There was an all-powerful magnetism between herself and Marius that made her instinctively and almost automatically do whatever Marius wanted. She sensed that Marius wanted something in regard to Monsieur Jean, and she fell into line. Her husband did not have to say a word to her. She felt the vague but clear pressure of his tacit intentions, and blindly complied. Her compliance here consisted in not remembering whatever Marius forgot. She did not need to make any effort to do this. Without herself knowing why, and without being in any way to blame, her soul had so thoroughly become her husband's that whatever was covered in darkness in Marius's thoughts grew dim in hers. Let's not go too far, though. In relation to Jean Valjean, this disregard and this erasure were only superficial. She was more unthinking than oblivious. In her heart of hearts, she was very fond of the man she had so long called her father, but she loved her husband even more. That is what had somewhat tipped her heart's balance in favor of one side only. It sometimes happened that Cosette spoke of Jean Valjean and expressed amazement. Then Marius would calm her down. He's away, I think. Didn't he say he was going on a trip?
That's true, Cosette thought. He was in the habit of disappearing like this, but not for so long.
Two or three times, she sent Nicolette around to the Rue de l'Homme Armé to find out whether Monsieur Jean was back from his trip. Jean Valjean had her say he was still away. Cosette did not inquire any further, having only one need on this earth, Marius. We should say further that, on their side, Marius and Cosette had been away. They had gone to Vernon. Marius had taken Cosette to his father's grave. Marius had little by little taken Cosette away from Jean Valjean. Cosette had let it happen. Besides, what people call much too harshly, in certain cases, the ingratitude of children, is not always as reprehensible as you might think. It is the ingratitude of nature. Nature, as we have already said elsewhere, looks straight ahead. Nature divides the living into those on the way in and those on the way out. Those on the way out are turned toward the darkness, those on the way in toward the light. Whence a gap that, for the old, is fatal, and for the young, involuntary. This gap is at first imperceptible, but it slowly increases like all dividing branches. The smaller branches, without breaking off the trunk, grow away from it. It is not their fault. Youth goes where there is joy, festivity, bright lights, love. Old age goes to the end. They do not lose sight of each other, but they lose their hold on each other. Young people feel the cooling effect of life. Old people, that of the grave. Let's not blame the poor children. Last flickerings of a lamp with no oil. One day Jean Valjean went downstairs, took three steps into the street, sat down on a curbstone. On that same curbstone where Gavroche, on the night of June 5th, had found him musing. He stayed there for a few minutes, then went back up. This was the last swing of the pendulum. The next day, he did not leave his room. The day after that, he did not leave his bed. His concierge, who prepared his frugal meal, a bit of cabbage and a few potatoes with a bit of streaky bacon, looked at the brown earthenware plate and cried, "But you didn't eat yesterday, you poor dear man."
"Yes, I did,"
replied Jean Valjean.
"The plate's still full."
"Look at the water pitcher. It's empty."
"That proves you drank. It doesn't prove you ate."
"Well, then," said Jean Valjean, "what if I was only hungry for water?"
"That's called thirst, and when you don't eat at the same time, it's called fever."
"I'll eat tomorrow."
"Or on Trinity Sunday. Why not today? Do you hear anyone else say, 'I'll eat tomorrow'? Fancy leaving me my plate full without touching it, and my red potatoes were so good."
Jean Valjean took the old woman's hand.
"I promise you I'll eat them,"
he said to her in his benign voice.
"I am not happy with you," answered the concierge.
Jean Valjean hardly saw any human being apart from this good woman. There are streets in Paris that no one walks down, and houses where no one comes. He was in one of those streets and in one of those houses. In the days when he still went out, he had bought a little copper crucifix for a few sous from a coppersmith, and he had hung it on a nail facing his bed. That particular gallows, the Holyrood, is always good to see. A week went by without Jean Valjean's taking a step even inside his room. He kept to his bed. The concierge said to her husband, "That old fellow from upstairs doesn't get up anymore, doesn't eat anymore. He won't last long. He's got his sorrows, that one has. You can't tell me his daughter hasn't made a bad match." The porter returned in the tone of husbandly supremacy. "If he's rich, he can get a doctor. If he's not rich, he can do without. If he doesn't get a doctor, he'll die.
And if he gets one,
he'll die."
The concierge began to scratch away at the grass that was growing in what she called her pavement with a knife, and while tearing out the grass, she mumbled, "That's a shame, an old man who's so clean. He's as white as a plucked chicken." She saw a local doctor going by at the end of the street and took it upon herself to ask him in. "It's on the second floor," she told him. "You can go straight in. Since the old fellow doesn't stir from his bed anymore, the key's always in the door." The doctor saw Jean Valjean and spoke to him.
When he came back downstairs, the concierge intercepted him. Well then, doctor?
Your sick man is very sick indeed.
What's he got?
Everything and nothing. That's a man who, to all appearances, has lost someone dear to him. A person can die of that.
What did he tell you?
He told me he was in good health.
Will you come back again, doctor?
Yes, answered the doctor.
But someone other than me has to come back.
A feather crushes the man who lifted Fauchelevent's cart. One evening, Jean Valjean had trouble lifting himself up on his elbow. He took his wrist and couldn't find the pulse. His breathing was shallow and stopped now and then. He realized that he was weaker than he had ever yet been. So, under pressure, no doubt from some ultimate overriding concern, he made an effort, sat up, and got dressed. He put on his old working man's gear. Not going out anymore, he had reverted to it and preferred it. He had to stop several times as he was dressing, and the sheer effort of getting his arms into the sleeves of his jacket made the sweat roll down his forehead. Since he had been on his own, he had put his bed in the antechamber so as to occupy the deserted apartment as little as possible. He opened the suitcase and pulled out Cosette's little bundle of clothes. He spread them out on the bed. The bishop's candlesticks were in their place on the mantelpiece. He took two beeswax candles out of a drawer and put them in the candlesticks. Then, though it was still broad daylight, in summer, he lit them. You sometimes see candles blazing away like this in the middle of the day in rooms where dead people lie. Every step he took going from one piece of furniture to the other wore him out, and he was forced to sit down. It was not the normal fatigue that expends strength in order to renew it. It was the last vestige of what motion was possible. It was life exhausted, and running out drop by drop in overwhelming efforts never to be made again. One of the chairs on which he now dropped had been placed in front of the mirror, so fatal for him, so providential for Marius, in which he had read Cosette's writing on the blotter backward. He saw himself in the mirror, but did not recognize himself. He looked 80 years old. Before Marius's marriage, you would scarcely have given him 50. This year had cost him 30. What he had on his forehead was not the wrinkles of age, but the mysterious mark of death. You could sense there the gouging of that pitiless claw. His cheeks sagged. The skin on his face was the color that makes it look like there is dirt over it already. Both corners of his mouth were turned down like the mask the ancients used to carve on tombs. He stared into space with an air of reproach. You would have taken him for one of those great tragic figures whose role is to lament someone. He was in that place, the last phase of desolation, where sorrow no longer flows down like a fountain. It has, so to speak, coagulated. The soul is blocked by a sort of clot of despair. Night had come. With great difficulty, he dragged the table and the old armchair over to the fireplace and placed on the table a quill pen, ink, and paper. That done, he fainted. When he regained consciousness, he was thirsty. Not being able to lift up the water pitcher, he tilted it painfully toward his mouth and gulped a mouthful down. Then he turned toward the bed and, still sitting down, for he could not remain on his feet, he looked at the tiny black dress and all those little objects so dear to his heart. Such contemplation can go on for hours that fly by like minutes. All of a sudden he shivered. He felt the cold coming over him. He leaned on the table, which the bishop's candlesticks lit, and he took up the pen. As neither the pen nor the ink had been used for a long time, the pen nib was bent, and the ink was dry. He had to get up and put a few drops of water in the ink, which he could only do by stopping and sitting down 2 or 3 times. And then he was forced to write with the back of the pen. He wiped his forehead from time to time. His hand was shaking. He slowly wrote the lines that follow. Cosette, I bless you. I am going to explain to you. Your husband was right in giving me to understand that I ought to clear off. Yet he was a little mistaken in what he believed, but he was right. He is a very good man. Always love him with all your heart, when I am dead. Monsieur Pontmercy, always love my beloved child. Cosette, they will find this note. Here is what I want to tell you. You will see the figures, if I have the strength to remember them. Listen carefully. The money really does belong to you. Here is the whole story. White jet comes from Norway. Black jet comes from England. Black glass beads come from Germany. Jet is lighter, more precious, more dear. We can make imitations in France, just as in Germany. You need a small anvil, 2 inches square, and a spirit lamp to soften the wax. The wax used to be made with resin and lamp black, and cost 4 francs a pound. I came up with the idea of making it with shellac and turpentine. It costs no more than 30 sous and is a lot better. Loops are made with a violet glass that you stick onto a small black iron plate frame using the wax. The glass should be violet for iron jewelry and black for gold jewelry. Spain buys a lot of it. That is the place for jet. Here he broke off. The pen fell from his fingers. One of those desperate sobs came over him that sometimes rose up from the very depths of his being. The poor man took his head in his hands and brooded. Oh, he cried inside. Lamentable cries heard by God alone. It's over. I won't see her again. She is a smile that brushed over me. I'm about to go into that dark night without even seeing her again. Oh, to hear her voice, touch her dress, look at her, my girl, that angel, if only for a minute, an instant, and then die. Dying is nothing. What is unbearable is dying without seeing her. She would give me a smile. She would have a word with me. Would that hurt anyone? No, it's over. Forever. Here I am, all alone. My God! My God! I will never see her again. At that moment, someone knocked on his door. Bottle of ink that only manages to whiten. That same day, or more precisely that same evening, as Marius had just left the table and retired to his office to study a case file, Basque had handed him a letter saying, "The person who wrote the letter is in the antechamber." Cosette had taken the grandfather's arm and was taking a turn in the garden. A letter, like a man, can look bad. Coarse paper, clumsy folding. The mere sight of certain missives puts you off. The letter Basque had brought was of this sort. Marius took it. It smelled of tobacco. Nothing evokes a memory like a smell. Marius recognized the tobacco. He looked at the address. To Monsieur le Baron Pontmercy, at his private hotel. Recognizing the tobacco made him recognize the handwriting. You could say that amazement has its flashes of insight. Malleus was, as it were, illuminated by one of those flashes. The sense of smell, that mysterious aide-mémoire, instantly brought a whole world back to him. This was indeed the paper, the way of folding, the watery tone of the ink. It was indeed the familiar handwriting, and more than anything else, it was the tobacco. The Jondrette garret appeared before him. What a strange stroke of luck! One of the two trails he had been hoping to find for so long, the one he'd gone to so much trouble over even recently, and that he'd thought forever cold, had come to offer itself to him of its own accord. He eagerly unsealed the letter and read, "Monsieur le Baron, if the Supreme Being had given me the talent for it, I could have been the Baron Thénard, member of the Institute, Académie des Sciences, but I am not. I merely bear the same name as him, happy if this reminder recommends me to the excellence of your bounties. The kindness you honor me with will be reciprocated. I am in possession of a secret concerning an individual. This individual concerns you. I hold the secret at your disposal, desiring to have the honor of being useful to you. I will give you the simple means of chasing from your honorable family this individual who has no right to it, Madame la Baronne being of high birth. The sanctuary of virtue could never cohabit any longer with crime without abdicating. I await in the antechamber the orders of Monsieur le Baron with respect. The letter was signed Thénard. This signature was not false. It was merely somewhat abbreviated. Besides, the gobbledygook and the spelling rounded off the revelation. The certificate of origin was complete. There could be no doubt whatsoever. Malthus's emotion was profound. After the initial surge of surprise, he felt a surge of happiness. If he could only find the other man now, the one who had saved his life, he would have nothing more to wish for. He opened a drawer in his secretaire, pulled out a few banknotes, shoved them in his pocket, closed the secretaire again, and rang. Basque opened the door a little. "Show him in," said Malthus. Basque announced, "Monsieur Thénard." A man entered. Fresh surprise for Malthus, the man who entered was someone he had never seen before in his life. This man, who was old on top of everything else, had a bulbous nose, a chin that disappeared into his cravat, green goggles with a double shade of green taffeta over his eyes, hair slicked down flat over his forehead to his eyebrows like the wigs of high-life English coach drivers. His hair was grey, he was dressed in black from head to foot, in a very threadbare but clean black. A bunch of charms hanging out of his fob pocket suggested a watch. He held an old hat in his hand. He walked with a stoop, and the curve of his back was accentuated by the very low bow he gave. What was striking at first sight was that the man's coat, although carefully buttoned up, was too big for him, and seemed to have been made for someone else. Here, a short digression is necessary. There was in Paris at the time, in a shady old dive, in the Rue Beautreuil, near the Arsenal, an ingenious Jew whose business it was to turn a scoundrel into a respectable man. Not for too long, which might have been uncomfortable for the scoundrel. The change was a set change in full view of the audience for a day or two, at the rate of 30 sous a day, by means of a costume as closely as possible resembling ordinary, average respectability. The costume hirer was called the Changer. The crooks of Paris had given him the name and did not know him by any other. He had a fairly complete wardrobe in stock. The rags with which he decked people out were roughly convincing. He had specialties and general categories. From every nail in his shop, a social condition hung, worn and crumpled. Here a magistrate's garb, there a priest's, there a banker's, in one corner a retired soldier's, elsewhere that of a man of letters, further away a statesman's. The man was the wardrobe master for the immense drama that skullduggery staged in Paris. His dive was the dressing room from which theft emerged and to which daylight robbery returned. A rogue in tatters showed up at this changing room, put down 30 sous, and chose the outfit that suited him, depending on the role he wanted to play that day. And when he went back downstairs, that rogue was suddenly somebody. The next day the costume was faithfully returned, and the changer, who trusted robbers with all his stock, was never robbed. These clothes had one drawback, though. They didn't fit, not being made for those who wore them. They were too tight on this one, baggy on that one, didn't fit anyone. Any crook who was bigger or smaller than the human average was ill at ease in the changer's costumes. You had to be not too fat and not too skinny. The changer only catered to normal men. He had taken the measure of the species in the person of the first thug to happen along, who was neither thick nor thin, neither tall nor small. Whence the sometimes difficult adaptations that the changer's customers had to try and get away with as best they could. Too bad for the exceptions. The statesman's outfit, for instance, which was black from top to bottom and consequently most seemly, would have been too big for Pitt and too small for Castelcicala. The garb of the statesman was described as follows in the changer's catalogue, which we quote: a coat of black cloth, trousers of black woolskin, a waistcoat of silk, boots and linen. In the margin was written ex-ambassador,
and a note that we also transcribe, in a separate box a wig properly frizzed, green spectacles, charms, and two small quill tubes, 1 inch long, wrapped in cotton. All this went with the statesman ex-ambassador. The whole costume was, if we may use the word, tired. The seams were going white, a sort of buttonhole was opening up on one of the elbows, and on top of this, a button was missing on the breast of the coat. But this was a mere detail, for the statesman's hand had always to be inside his coat over his heart, the purpose being to hide the missing button. If Marius had been familiar with the occult institutions of Paris, he would immediately have recognized, on the back of the visitor that Basque had just shown in, the statesman's outfit borrowed from the Take That One Down For Me of the changer. Marius's disappointment at seeing a man enter who was not the man he was expecting turned to displeasure with the newcomer. He looked him up and down while the character was busy bowing exaggeratedly, and he asked him in a crisp tone, "What do you want?" The man answered with an amiable grimace, not unlike a crocodile's grin.
"It does not seem possible to me that I have not already had the honor of seeing Monsieur le Baron about town. I really do think I met him in particular a few years ago at Madame la Princesse Bagration's and in the salons of his lordship the Vicomte d'Ambre, peer of France."
It is always a good tactic in crooked dealings to seem to recognize someone you don't know. Marius paid close attention to the man's speech. He focused on the accent and the gestures, but his disappointment only grew. This man's was a nasal tone, absolutely unlike the sharp, dry voice he was expecting. He was completely thrown. "I do not know," he said, "either Madame Bagration or Monsieur d'Ambre. I have never in my life set foot in either's house." The reply was gruff. The character, gracious even so, insisted,
"Then it must have been at Chateaubriand's that I saw Monsieur. I know Chateaubriand very well, a most affable man. He sometimes says to me, 'Thénard, my friend, won't you have a drink with me?'"
Marius's forehead became more and more stern. "I have never had the honor of being received at Monsieur de Chateaubriand's. Let's get to the point. What do you want?" Confronted by the harder tone of voice, the man bowed even lower.
"Monsieur le Baron, deign to hear me out. In America, in a region close to Panama, there is a village called La Jolla. This village consists of a lone house, a big, square, three-story house made of bricks baked in the sun, each side of the square 500 feet long, each floor set back 12 feet from the floor below, so that every floor has a terrace in front of it that runs round the entire building. At the center, an inner courtyard where the provisions and munitions are kept. No windows, only loopholes. No door, only ladders. Ladders to go up from the ground to the first terrace, and from the first to the second, and from the second to the third. Ladders to go down into the inner courtyard. No doors on the rooms, only trap doors. No stairs to the rooms, only ladders. At night, they shut the trap doors. They take away the ladders. They level blunderbusses and carbines out the loopholes. No means of gaining entry, a house by day, a citadel by night, 800 inhabitants, and that's the village for you. Why so many precautions? Because the region's dangerous. It's full of cannibals. So why do people go there? Because it's a marvelous region. It's where you find gold."
"What are you getting at?" Marius broke in, having shifted from disappointment to impatience.
"This, Monsieur le Baron, I am a tired old ex-diplomat. The old world has given me an appetite. I'd like to try savages."
"And?"
"Monsieur le Baron, selfishness makes the world go round. The landless peasant woman who works by the day turns round when a stagecoach goes by. The land-owning peasant woman laboring in her own field doesn't turn round. The poor man's dog barks at the rich man. The rich man's dog barks at the poor man. Every man for himself. Self-interest. That's man's purpose in life. And gold is the lodestone."
"So, get to the point."
"I'd like to go and set myself up in La Jolla. There are three of us. I have a missus and a young lady, a very beautiful girl. The voyage is long and dear. I need a bit of money."
"What's this got to do with me?" asked Marius. The stranger poked his neck up out of his cravat in a movement peculiar to the vulture, and replied with a smile twice as big,
"Could it be that Monsieur le Baron has not read my letter?"
This was very nearly the case. The fact is that the contents of the epistle had glanced off Marius. He had taken in the writing more than what it said. He could hardly remember a word of it. For a moment now, a new suspicion had been aroused by a new clue falling into place. He had noticed that detail, a missus and a young lady. He fixed a piercing eye on the stranger. An examining magistrate could not have done better. He was almost lying in wait for him. He kept his answer brief. "Be more specific." The stranger thrust both hands in both fob pockets, threw back his head without straightening up his spine, but scrutinized Marius in turn through the green glare of his glasses.
"Right you are, Monsieur le Baron. I will be more specific. I have a secret to sell you."
"A secret?"
"A secret."
"That concerns me?"
"Somewhat."
"What is this secret?" Marius examined the man more and more intensely as he listened to him.
"I'll begin gratis," said the stranger. "You'll see that I'm worth your while."
"Go on."
"Monsieur le Baron, you have under your roof a thief and a murderer."
Marius jumped. "Under my roof? No," he said. The stranger brushed his hat with his elbow, imperturbable, and went on.
"Murderer and thief. Note, Monsieur le Baron, that I am not talking here about deeds that are old, bygone, null and void, that can be cancelled out by statutory limitation in the eye of the law and by repentance in the eye of God. I'm talking about recent deeds, current deeds, deeds justice is still ignorant of, even as we speak. I shall proceed. This man has insinuated himself into your confidence and almost into your family, under a false name. I am going to tell you his real name, and tell it to you for nothing."
"I'm listening."
"His name is Jean Valjean."
"I know."
"I am going to tell you also for nothing who he is."
"Go on."
"He is an ex-convict."
"I know."
"You know since I had the honor of telling you."
"No, I knew beforehand." Marius's cold tone, that double retort, "I know," his terseness, so unamenable to dialogue, stirred mute fury in the stranger. He shot Marius a furtive look of rage, immediately extinguished. As fast as it was, that look was the kind you recognize when you have seen it before. It did not escape Marius. Certain flashes of fire can only come from certain souls. The eye, that cellar window of thought, is set ablaze. Glasses hide nothing. You might as well stick a pane of glass on hell. The stranger went on, smiling.
"I would not allow myself to contradict Monsieur le Baron. In any case, you must see that I am well informed. Now, what I am about to tell is known to myself alone. It concerns the fortune of Madame la Baronne. It is an extraordinary secret. It is for sale. I offer it to you first. Dirt cheap. 20,000 francs.
"I know that secret just as I know the others," said Marius. The character felt the need to lower his price a little.
"Monsieur le Baron, say 10,000 francs and I'll talk."
"I repeat that you have nothing to tell me. I know what you want to say." There was a fresh flash in the man's eyes. He shouted,
"I still have to eat today. It's an extraordinary secret, I tell you. Monsieur le Baron, I am going to talk. I am talking. Give me 20 francs.
Marius stared at him. "I know your extraordinary secret, just as I knew the name Jean Valjean, just as I know your name."
"My name?"
"Yes."
"That's not hard, Monsieur le Baron. I had the honor of writing it for you and of telling it to you. Thénardier."
"Huh?
Thénardier. Who's that?"
"When in danger, the porcupine bristles. The scarab plays dead, the old guard forms a square, this man started to laugh." Then he brushed a speck of dust from his coat sleeve with a flick. Marius continued, "You are also the working man Jondrette, the comedian Fabantou, the poet Jean Flo, the Spaniard Don Alvarez, and Mother Balizar."
"Mother what?"
"And you used to keep a greasy spoon of a place in Montfermeil.
A greasy spoon? Never. And I tell you, you are Thénardier. I deny it, and you are a beggar of a man. Here.
And Marius, pulling a banknote out of his pocket, threw it in his face.
Thanks. Pardon. 500 francs, Monsieur le Baron.
And the man, overcome, bowing and scraping, grabbed the note and examined it.
500 francs,
he repeated, flabbergasted, and he stammered under his breath,
a serious scrap of paper.
Then abruptly,
all right, you're on, he cried. Let's make ourselves comfortable.
And, with the swiftness of a monkey, tossing his hair back, ripping off his glasses, taking out of his nose and pocketing the two quill tubes we mentioned a moment ago, and which we have already seen, as it happens on another page of this book, he took his face off as you take off a hat. His eyes lit up, his forehead, uneven, deeply lined, lumpy, hideously wrinkled at the top, cleared, his nose regained its beak-like sharpness, the ferocious and acute profile of the man of prey reappeared.
"Monsieur le Baron is infallible," he said in a clear voice, free of any nasal twang. "I am Thénardier."
And he straightened up, his hunched back. Thénardier, for it was indeed he, was strangely taken aback. He'd have been rocked if that were possible for him. He had come to deliver a shock, and it was he who had received one. This humiliation had been compensated for by 500 francs, and, all in all, he accepted it. But he was no less stunned. He was seeing this Baron Pontmercy for the very first time, and, despite his disguise, this Baron Pontmercy recognized him, and recognized him good and proper. And not only did this Baron know exactly who Thénardier was, but he seemed to know all about Jean Valjean, too. Who was this practically beardless young man, so glacial and so generous, who knew people's names, who knew all their names, and who opened his purse to them, who bullied crooks about like a judge, and who paid them like a mug? Thénardier, you will recall, although once living next door to Marius, had never set eyes on him, which happens often enough in Paris. He had once vaguely heard his daughters talking about a very poor young man named Marius who lived in the house. He had written him the letter we know about without knowing him. There was no possible connection in his mind between that Marius and this Monsieur le Baron Pontmercy. As for the name Pontmercy, you will recall that on the battlefield of Waterloo, he had only caught the last two syllables, for which he had always held the legitimate contempt we owe to mere thanks. Otherwise, through his daughter Azelma, whom he had set on the trail of the newly married couple of February 16th, and through his own digging, he had managed to find out a lot of things, and from the depths of his darkness, he had succeeded in seizing more than one mysterious thread. He had, by dint of industry, discovered, or at the very least, by dint of induction, divined who the man was that he had encountered on a certain day in the Grand Sewer. From the man, he had easily arrived at the name. He knew that Madame la Baronne Pontmercy was Cosette, but on that score he intended to be discreet. Who was Cosette? He himself did not really know. He caught a whiff of bastardy, Fantine's story having always struck him as fishy, but what was the good of bringing it up? To get his silence paid for? He had, or thought he had, something better than that for sale. And, to all appearances, to come along without proof and make this revelation to the Baron Pontmercy. Your wife is a bastard. Well, it would only succeed in attracting the husband's boot to the revealer's backside. To Thénardier's way of thinking, the conversation with Marius had not yet got off the ground. He had had to retreat, modify his strategy, abandon one position, change tack. But nothing essential had yet been jeopardized, and he had 500 francs in his pocket. Moreover, he had something decisive to say, and even vis-à-vis this Baron Pontmercy, well-informed and well-armed as he was, he felt himself to be in a strong position. For men of Thénardier's ilk, all dialogue is a battle. In the one that was about to begin, how did he stand? He did not know who he was talking to, but he knew what he was talking about. He swiftly made this internal review of his forces, and after agreeing, "I am Thénardier," he hung fire. Marius had remained pensive. So, he had Thénardier at last. The man whom he had wanted so badly to find once more was there. So he would be able to honor Colonel Pontmercy's injunction. He felt humiliated that that hero had owed anything to this crook, and that the bill of exchange drawn on Marius by his father from the bottom of the grave should have been outstanding till that day. It also seemed to him, in the complex state his mind was in over Thénardier,
that there was good reason to avenge the colonel for the misfortune of having been saved by such a scoundrel. But whatever else happened, he was satisfied. Finally, he was going to free the colonel's shade from the clutches of this unworthy creditor, and it seemed to him that he was about to release his father's memory from debtor's jail. Alongside this duty, he had another, which was to throw light, if possible, on the source of Cosette's fortune. The opportunity seemed to present itself. Thénardier did perhaps know something. It might be useful to sound the man out. He would start with that. Thénardier had slipped the serious scrap of paper into his fob pocket and was looking at Marius with an almost tender sweetness. Marius broke the silence. Thénardier, I've told you what your name is. Now, your secret, what you've come to tell me, would you like me to tell you what it is? I know more about it than you do. Jean Valjean, as you say, is a murderer and a thief. A thief since he robbed a rich manufacturer, Monsieur Madeleine, whose ruin he caused. A murderer since he murdered the police officer Javert.
I don't understand, Monsieur le Baron, said Thénardier.
I'll make myself clearer. Listen, sometime around 1822, in an arrondissement of the Pas-de-Calais, there was a man who had had some kind of scrape with the law some time before, and who, under the name of Monsieur Madeleine, got back on his feet and rehabilitated himself. This man became a just man in the full force of the term. With an industry, the manufacture of black glass beads, he made the fortune of a whole town. As for his personal fortune, he made that too, but only secondarily, and in a way, incidentally. He was a foster father to the poor. He founded hospitals, opened schools, visited the sick, provided for daughters, supported widows, adopted orphans. He was the guardian, so to speak, of the district. He turned down the cross. He was appointed mayor. A freed convict knew the secret about a sentence that was incurred by this man. He denounced him and had him arrested, and took advantage of the arrest to come to Paris, to Lafitte, the bankers, and withdraw using a false signature. I heard this from the cashier himself, a sum of more than half a million belonging to Monsieur Madeleine. This convict who robbed Monsieur Madeleine is Jean Valjean. As for the other deed, you have nothing to tell me there either. Jean Valjean killed the police officer Javert. He shot him with a pistol. I, who am speaking to you now, was there. Thénardier threw Marius the withering look of a beaten man, who once more suddenly has his hand on victory and has just clawed back in one go all the ground he had lost. But the smile was back in place immediately. The inferior can only enjoy an obsequious triumph in front of the superior, and Thénardier contented himself with saying to Marius,
Monsieur le Baron, we are on the wrong track.
And he emphasized this phrase by giving his bunch of charms an expressive twirl. What? Marius returned. Do you contest it? Those are the facts.
Those are fantasies you're dreaming. The confidence with which Monsieur le Baron honors me makes it my duty to say so. Truth and justice, first and foremost. I don't like seeing people accused unjustly. Monsieur le Baron, Jean Valjean did not rob Monsieur Madeleine, and Jean Valjean did not kill Javert.
That's a good one. How do you work that out?
Two reasons.
Which are? Go on.
The first is this. He didn't rob Monsieur Madeleine, given that he, Jean Valjean, is himself Monsieur Madeleine.
What are you talking about?
And the second is this. He didn't murder Javert, given that the man who killed Javert is Javert.
What do you mean?
That Javert committed suicide. Prove it. Prove it!
Marius shrieked, losing control. Thénardier went on, scanning his sentence in the manner of a classical Alexandrine.
The police officer Javert was found drowned under a boat at the Pont au Change.
So prove it, then. Thénardier pulled from his side pocket a large grey paper envelope that looked as if it contained folded pages of different sizes.
I have my file, he said calmly. And he added, Monsieur le Baron, for your sake, I wanted to know my Jean Valjean backward. I say that Jean Valjean and Madeleine are the same man, and I say that Javert had no killer other than Javert. And when I say something, it's because I have proof. Not handwritten proof. Handwriting is suspicious. Writing is lax, but proof in print.
As he spoke, Thénardier extracted from the envelope two editions of newspapers, yellowed, faded,
and highly saturated with tobacco. One of these two newspapers, torn at the creases and falling apart in squared-off strips, looked a lot older than the other.
Two facts, two pieces of proof, said Thénardier,
and he handed Marius the two newspapers unfolded and spread out. These two newspapers are familiar to the reader. One, the older one, an edition of the Drapeau Blanc of July 25, 1823, the text of which can be found on page 301 of this book, established that Monsieur Madeleine and Jean Valjean were identical. The other, a Moniteur of June 15, 1832, recorded Javert's suicide, adding that it resulted from a report by Javert to the prefect that, having been made a prisoner in the barricade in the Rue de la Chanvrerie, he had owed his life to the magnanimity of an insurgent who, while holding him with his pistol, instead of blowing his brains out, had fired into the air. Marius read. Here was evidence. Certain date, irrefutable proof. These two newspapers had not been printed expressly to support Thénardier's story. The note published in the Moniteur was an official communique of the Prefecture of Police. Marius could not doubt it. The bank clerk's information was false, and he himself had been mistaken. Jean Valjean, suddenly looming large, emerged from the cloud cover. Marius could not hold back a cry of joy. So then, that poor unfortunate man is a wonderful man. That whole fortune really did belong to him. He is Madeleine, the salvation of a whole region. He is Jean Valjean, the savior of Javert. He is a hero. He is a saint.
He is not a saint and he is not a hero, said Thénardier. He is a murderer and a thief.
And he added, in the voice of a man who feels he is gaining the upper hand,
let's calm down, shall we?
Thief, murderer. These words that Marius had thought banished returned and crashed over him like a shower of ice. Still, he said,
still, said Thénardier. Jean Valjean did not rob Monsieur Madeleine, but he is still a thief. He did not kill Javert, but he is still a murderer.
You're not talking, Marius shot back, about that miserable petty theft of 40 years ago, expiated, as appears from your very own newspapers, by a whole lifetime of repentance, self-denial, and good.
I say murder and theft, Monsieur le Baron, and I repeat that I'm talking about current deeds. What I have to reveal to you is absolutely unknown. It's a scoop. And maybe it's where you'll find the source of the fortune cunningly offered by Jean Valjean to Madame la Baronne. I say cunningly, for through a donation of the kind, to slip into an honorable household, the comforts of which he will share, and by the same token cover up his crime, to enjoy the fruits of his theft, bury his name, and create himself a family, that would not be particularly inept.
I could interrupt you here, observed Marius, but go on.
Monsieur le Baron, I will tell you all, leaving the reward to your generosity. This secret is worth its weight in gold. You'll say to me, why didn't you go to Jean Valjean? For a very simple reason, I know that he has dispossessed himself, and dispossessed himself in your favor. And I find the scheme ingenious. But he no longer has a sou. He would just show me his empty pockets, and since I need some money for my trip to La Hoya, I prefer you. You have the lot to him. He has nothing.
I'm a little weary. Allow me to take a seat. Marius sat down and gestured for him to sit. Thénardier settled into a padded chair, took back the two newspapers, thrust them back in the envelope, and muttered, tapping the Drapeau Blanc with his nail,
I went to a lot of trouble to get this one.
That done, he crossed his legs and lay back in his chair in the manner of a man who is sure of what he is saying. Then he took the plunge and tackled the subject gravely, stressing every word with great emphasis.
Monsieur le Baron, the 6th of June, 1832, roughly a year ago, the day of the riot, there was a man in the Grand Sewer of Paris, over where the sewer comes out at the Seine, between the Pont des Invalides and the Pont d'Iéna.
Marius abruptly brought his chair closer to Thénardier's. Thénardier registered the movement and went on at the slow pace of an orator who holds his audience in the palm of his hand and feels his enemy squirming under his words.
This man was forced to go into hiding, though for reasons that have nothing to